right, friends, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. I'm really looking forward to this hour because my guest is my dear colleague and author of three books that you probably are familiar with, Keeping Your Kids on God's Side, 40 Conversations to Help Them Build Lasting Faith, Talking to Your Kids About God, 30 Conversations Every Christian Must Have, and Talking to Your Kids About Jesus, 30 More Conversations Every Christian Parent Must Have. Of course, I'm talking about Natasha Crane. And Natasha, I think you're kind of like the patron saint of Christian moms. What do you think?
I don't know about that, but hopefully I've helped to equip some of them.
Well, you've really come to the rescue of families with this wonderful work that you've done. And by the way, are you still hosting your blog, Christian Moms? Christian Mom Thoughts, I guess, right?
Well, that was the original name of it. But I do still have a blog, but I don't use that name anymore. It's just natashacrane.com. If you go to Natasha Crane, last name spelled C-R-A-I-N.com, that's where you can find articles that I'm writing and have a podcast now too, the Natasha Crane Podcast. So I post about that there as well.
Okay, that's good. I may have to have you remind me of those details again later in the show so people can get it again. But you have a new book now called Faithfully Different, the subtitle Regaining Biblical Clarity in a Secular Culture. Your first book was in 2016, second in 2017, third in 2020. Now you have 2021. You've got a fourth book. I thought you were a Christian mom. How do you have time for any of that and managing your family and everything else you do? It's amazing. I mean, that's four books in, 5 years? Like, yikes. Good for you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it is a challenge. It absolutely is. And sometimes I look back and I have no idea where I found the time in between all of these things to do it. And the last year I've been homeschooling for the first time, too. So that's been an extra big challenge, but it's been a blessing to be able to do it.
Well, you did a great job here. The book is currently Amazon's number one new release in Christian apologetics. Came out a week ago today. Right. And today I checked, it's $12.68 on Amazon overall. That's magnificent. Actually, last week when it first came out, because it was a great buildup, I was watching it online, and you were in the 600s or something on Amazon. I mean, to break the top 10,000 is very cool for any author. Here you broke the top 1,000, and you're still going strong at $12.68, and you've just started really promoting your book here this week. And if it doesn't embarrass you too much, I would like to read at least the first paragraph of my own personal endorsement of this book. Is that okay with you?
Please do. It's an honor to have your endorsement in it and really appreciate that.
What I said was Natasha Crane's Faithfully Different offers a brilliant assessment of our current cultural moment, loaded with insight, yet perfectly practical, in prose that is lucid and crystal clear. Crane strikes a healthy balance between her native kindness and gentleness, there you go, which is true about you, and her sharp biblical thinking, also true about you, helping you discover, finally, how all the crazy cultural pieces fit together and what to do about it. That's just, you know, my first paragraph. I have a longer critique. I read every word, and I stand behind every one of those words. I think, Natasha, that people, parents especially, are facing what appears to them like a kind of Gordian knot. All of the cultural pressures that they're facing and their kids are facing, and they don't know not only not how to understand what's going on, untying the Gordian knot, this unsolvable problem for them, they don't even know where to start because they don't understand the issues. And it seems to me this is the kind of thing that has motivated you to pursue this different area of writing, very different than what you've done before. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think it actually, the catalyst for all of this was back in the summer of 2020 with all the social unrest that was going on. And prior to that, I'd really been focused on writing about apologetics just for parents. It was always very tailored to that audience. But when all of this was going on with that social unrest, I realized there's a lot of confusion right now where a lot of secular views are creeping into people's biblical worldviews or where they shouldn't be. And so I decided to write a blog post about how Christians were getting swept into a secular worldview in that cultural moment. And to my surprise, it went viral and it was shared 277,000 times. And people were emailing me for weeks saying, thank you for writing about this. I couldn't quite put my finger on what was wrong with some of these ideas that are out there in culture, but now I'm seeing it more. So I started writing more articles about what was going on, and each of them got shared thousands and thousands of times. And I realized there's really a need for this to analyze the culture in terms of secularism as a worldview and contrast that with the biblical worldview, because they were seeping together for so many. And so that was really the catalyst behind the book, is saying, let's clarify these for people.
You hit a nerve, and this is a big, giant nerve. In fact, after this season of reality, which you've spoken for us at. Actually, you spoke for us in September in Orange County, because that was close to your home. So you spoke for us there. You haven't been here for the whole cycle. But the next cycle, we are dealing exclusively with the kinds of issues that you deal with here in your book. I don't know if we got you on schedule for that or not, but I certainly made my best plug for you. I'm not in charge of making those decisions. But in any event, though, I remember when I first found out about what you were doing, and somehow we got in a conversation about my frustration that expressed itself in a talk that I'd given that had also been a solid ground called Faithfulness is Not Theologically Complicated. And you said, that's the kind of thing I want to address in this book, that Christians are really confused on things they shouldn't be confused on, when you think from a biblical perspective. So what is creating confusion for so many Christians that shouldn't be confused?
Well, there's a lot I think we could talk about with that, but I think it starts with just understanding the Bible. It sounds so basic, right? It sounds like the answer to all Christian questions. Well, we need to understand the Bible, but it's just the truth. If we're not in the Word, we're not consistently reading, we don't understand how it fits together, not just as individual stories that we might hear and read and listen to the sermons about in church. If we don't understand how that then translates to an entire worldview, then we get confused, because we are a shrinking minority in the culture, which I detail in chapter one, all the statistics behind that. And not only are we a shrinking minority, but the cultural hostilities around us are coming from this worldview that is so at odds with a biblical one. And so when you don't fully understand the worldview that you think that you have or that you should have, and then you're constantly surrounded by challenges to it, then you're confused on where you want to be and where you're headed. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is that people need clarity on both of those ends. And that's what I hope to get to in the book, is looking at both pieces of that to distinguish them and show why they are so different and why we need to hold fast to the biblical.
Yeah, and I think you do a great job of that, in with, like I said in my own review, tremendous clarity and tremendous grace. I think that I remember when Bruce Jenner came out, you know, a number of years ago with transgender, and that whole thing exploded, how the staff at Stand to Reason encouraged me to make a video in response to it. And I thought to myself, I said to them, what do we need to make a video about? What's confusing about this? Bruce Jenner is confused and the culture is confused. Isn't that obvious? But I ended up making the video because it was necessary, because so many people were getting in touch with us asking for our assessment. And my assessment was just because some people in the culture are confused doesn't mean we need to be confused. And this is a going back to the nature of reality as expressed by Scripture. The way I want to chat about these things, I do want to talk about this cultural problem, because this is there is a kind of invasion going on, it seems to me, and has been going on for a long time, the influence of secularism on Christianity. But I think the eye catcher for me, as I began reading your book and other things like that, was the realization that there are a whole lot of Christians that aren't Christians, to put it in a certain simple way. Okay, let's talk about that for a little bit. What are the polls showing about people who self-identify as Christians and what they actually believe?
Yeah, so this is an important starting point, because a lot of people, when they hear you say, oh, Christians are a minority, they get really upset about that. They say, how can you say that? All the research shows that most of the people in the U.S. claim to be a Christian. This is true. Mm-hmm. So we have to really understand the data behind this. So the Pew Forum is an institution that's really highly regarded in terms of their research on religious trends in America. And they do these huge religious landscape studies. And what they found in their most recent one, I think it was 2019, is that 65% of Americans say that they're a Christian. So if they call people up and they're asking them, you know, here's a list of things, do you identify as an atheist, agnostic, Mormon, Jew, Christian, whatever, 65% of people will say, I'm a Christian. But what we have to understand is that's based on self-identification. So somebody could mean literally anything by that. They might not have been to a church in 30 years, but they grew up in a Christian family. It's kind of the closest thing that they associate with. Or maybe somebody loosely considers themselves to be a follower of Jesus in some way, but they're not living the kind of life or holding to the kinds of beliefs that one would think when someone hears the word Christian. So what we have to do is dig deeper into some research that looks at what do people actually believe? What is their worldview? And this research comes from Arizona Christian University's Cultural Research Center and I'm Dr. George Barna.
Yeah, we talked about that on the show before, but I think it's certainly worthy of a recap. Go ahead.
Yeah, they've produced amazing research on people's actual beliefs and behaviors and not just their self-identification. And in their most recent work in the American Worldview Inventory, what they have found, and this is based on dozens of questions, so this is looking, I think, at 40 to 50 questions about what people believe, about 6% of Americans have some kind of functioning biblical worldview, adhering to basic truths as taught in the Bible, and then seeking to live accordingly. So this is a shocking gap. And by the way, millennials, so 18 to 29-year-olds, that number falls to 2%. So 2% have a biblical worldview.
Well, I remember, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and I was going to say, and then the final little statistic to throw in there is that even within the church, we're a minority. So within the church, evangelical Protestant churches, 21% of people have a biblical worldview.
Okay, so what troubles me about those numbers, other than the numbers themselves, is when you read the fine print. So you look at the 62 or 65% of self-identifying Christians in the United States. Wow, cool. Well, read the fine print. Then you find out it's only like 20% or less than that, depending on which slice of Christianity you're talking about. But then you read the fine print again and find out how many of these people turn out to be moral relativists, how many of these people, and I'm just trying to recall the statistics, 25 and 45 keep jumping in here. It's either 25 or 45 for either of these three things. That is, it doesn't matter what faith you believe in as long as you believe in a faith. So Jesus isn't actually necessary. This is the people with Christian worldview hold this. This is the smaller number. Or they're moral relativists, you know, for example, or other things. Or the Holy Spirit's not real. There goes the Trinity. And so when I was trying to do my own math, it looked like functionally I would be surprised if there were 5%, and these were not asking any sexual questions that I saw, at least in the summary, so who knows what they believe in that. 5%, 4%, maybe 3% are actual followers of Christ who believe the right things and live the right way in the most basic sense, which is smaller than the number of atheists in this country, which is about 5% now. It used to be a smaller number. So this ought to rattle our cages in a big way. Why is this? You talk about the influence of secularization. There's a certain appeal. Talk about this corrosive and aggressive influence of secular culture on Christianity. You do a lot of work with that in your book.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that theoretically, we could have a situation where we're in this small minority in a culture that has a dominant worldview that's unappealing to us. Theoretically, that would be possible, right? That we're not feeling the pressure of it because it's something that just doesn't appeal. But that's not what we see. Secularism is very appealing to us, and to understand why, we have to sort of define it first. So by secular, if you think about secular in a political sense, for example, secular means that a country does not defer to the authority of a given religion or God in its public life, right? So an individual in the same way would be secular and have a secular worldview if they don't defer to the authority of a given religion or God in their own life. But here's the thing, and this is what's really important to understand. When you take away that authority of a given religion or God, you are not left with no authority. You are left with the authority of you, of the self. Mm. And mm-hmm. that is the tie that functionally binds the worldviews of millions of people. They might have all kinds of individual beliefs, but it comes back to your source of authority, of the authority of the self. Whereas in a biblical worldview, our authority, of course, should be God and what he has revealed through his inspired and authoritative word. Mm-hmm. So this is the huge distinction that I really work out in the book. And the Bible tells us why secularism is so appealing. Because ultimately, the Bible tells us that every single one of us, by our very nature, wants to go our own way. We want to go away from God. We want to be our own authority. We want to be the boss. Every single one of us, even as Christians, we struggle with the flesh as well. We struggle with wanting the authority of the self. So yes, secularism is what surrounds us in this culture. And it also happens to be an extremely appealing worldview because of our very nature as human beings, mm-hmm. based on what the Bible itself tells us.
Well, this reminds me of the common slogan, you do you, and I'm trying to think, was it during, I don't watch sports except for the Super Bowl, and then I just choose a team to cheer for. Of course, I was cheering for the Rams and they won, that was good, but I don't watch the halftime show because it just has gotten so gross. But there was something that came on, maybe it was a commercial, and I was listening to the lyrics of it, and the appeal of a lot of these commercials is reflecting this dogma now that comes across everywhere. You do you. Whatever you want, you can do it. Don't listen to other people. Don't be conformed to other people's ideas of what's good and right and beautiful. You do you. And of course, all the characters that are in these are these really hip folk, and they're hip because they're so extreme and compared to the conventional people. And this is the message that's being shouted. That's appealing. And especially you mix in the sexual stuff, you know, that adds a whole new dimension here, the sexual latitude and liberty. This is really, really hard, I think, for Christians to face. Do you think that this is part of, we haven't talked about deconstruction yet, I want to talk some more about the secularism, but do you think this press of the culture looking so appealing is part of why Christians are now deconstructing and questioning the legitimacy of their own prior convictions?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, I break down these four sort of tenets of a secular worldview, that feelings are the ultimate guide, happiness is the ultimate goal, judging is the ultimate sin, and God is the ultimate guest, that there's no reason for any confidence that God exists or has revealed himself in some way. Mm-hmm. So when we are constantly surrounded by this messaging, I compare it to a marketing campaign. It's sort of a ubiquitous marketing campaign for a worldview that we see in Super Bowl ads, that we see right. in the entertainment that we consume, that we see literally on billboards for products. It's everywhere. It is like a worldview that is being marketed to us. So after a while, given that our human nature ultimately wants to go our own way, when we keep seeing these messages that you're the only expert on you, you're the one, your feeling should be the guide because no one can tell you what to do. You're the only one who knows your feelings. And mm-hmm. happiness is the goal. If you're not feeling happy, something must be wrong. If you're not happy, then you need to pursue something else based on your feelings being the guide. Mm-hmm. And so when people start to hear these messages so much, absolutely, it makes you question what you believe, because if you're not totally happy, and that's supposedly the goal as culture puts it to us, then maybe mm-hmm. you start thinking, hey, all these people who are deconverting or deconstructing, they are saying they're very happy now. Maybe they have something and they figured something out that I haven't. I need to pursue this happiness. And mm-hmm. so that's not the goal according to a biblical worldview. Of course, we would like to be happy in our circumstances, but it's the joy found in the Lord, which is a much deeper type of happiness than just right. these temporary feelings that we have. So it goes that's back right. to also being biblically literate and knowing what the Bible says, because when you understand that we're supposed to deny ourselves and take up our cross to follow Jesus mm-hmm. because he is the truth, that's such a different view than what the culture is telling us. But when we can't distinguish between those, we get sucked in and we start mm-hmm. thinking there's something wrong with our faith or something wrong with the truth of Christianity.
Well, there has been this strain in Christianity for a long time that I have always thought was, in a certain sense, overly triumphant. everything's wonderful and it ought to always be wonderful. So you have this strain that isn't entirely transparent and honest about the struggles, but then you also have the word faith theology that say we ought to be happy, we ought to be fulfilled, we ought to be rich, we ought to be healthy, all of those things, and that's part of godliness. And sometimes I remind people, you know, the book of Hebrews was written to suffering Christians. The book of 1 Peter was written to suffering Christians. 1 Thessalonians, suffering Christians. 2 Thessalonians, suffering Christians. Philippians, suffering, right down the line. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 2 Timothy, written by Paul, who was in prison. And so this is not the biblical view of reality. The biblical view of reality is something different entirely. And I don't, my one concern, I don't know if you have an opinion about this, but this is a concern that I have of the church communicating what is true, not just true about Christianity, that Christianity is the truth and here are the reasons for it, but what is true about the reality of living a Christian life in a fallen world where the fallen world opposes you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's not enough time given to that because everything is sort of intended almost to lift you up constantly without acknowledging the place where many people are. And so I think you're absolutely right about that. We don't spend enough time talking about the fact that being a Christian is going to be very hard a lot of times, that we're still going to have these circumstances in life. It's not just, oh, if you have enough faith, you're going to be prosperous in all these ways. That's a totally errant theology. And when you have too much of that going on in culture, then Christians start getting the wrong ideas and don't realize that suffering is going to be part of this life.
Well, you know what? Suffering is not just part of the life for the Christian, it's part of the life for the non-Christian too. And even those that are following feelings as the ultimate guide, happiness as the ultimate goal, judging as the ultimate sin, and God as the ultimate guess. But that is not going to be portrayed on the Super Bowl halftime or any of the ads or any of the other kinds of ways that these alternate views, ultimately false views of reality, are going to be promoted. No, it's always made to look wonderful. And, you know, anyway, it's so frustrating to me because when you're aware how these ideas work, you see the lies there, but it's frustrating to see so many Christians taken in by them. What about social media? We haven't touched on that yet, but this is part of the secular enterprise that is powerful and persuasive. Talk about that a little bit in this broader element of the secularization of Christians.
Yeah, it puts a lot of pressure on us. So ultimately, the book is about secular pressures, and it adds to that pressure when we start to see the kinds of things that not only our friends are posting, but that other friends are liking and that they're sharing. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like everyone's just voting for a worldview in a sense. They'll post something, and you know, it might be something as simple as, you know, love is all that matters, or love is love, whatever it is like that.
Love is love, right?
And everyone loves these kinds of messages, but they're really based in a secular worldview. They sound nice on the surface, but they're really based in a secular worldview without taking the time to even define, well, what does love mean? No one takes the time to think this deeply about things today. We just like these little messages, and then everyone clicks to like and to share, and you see all this going on, and you kind of take that microcosm and extrapolate it and say, well, this is what everyone thinks. And every one of us is sort of subject to feeling once in a while when we look around and we're like, gosh, everyone else is buying this. Everyone else is seeing this. Am I missing something? We're all subject to that. So I think that it really does add a lot of pressure when you're on social media, because it's kind of like in lifetime, you're seeing people voting in a sense for worldviews by what they're posting, what they're sharing, how they comment. And it can make you question, why do I believe what I believe?
Well, there's another element too, and that's the cancel culture, which means that if you stand up against that or even offer a contrary view, not necessarily against it where you're saying, yeah, that's false and this is true, and you're being aggressively contradicting these things, which I think Christianity does do that on many of these issues. But if you just say, gee, I'm not so sure I go along with that. You know, if you just raise a legitimate question, kapow, you get whacked by these same powers that are advancing these messages.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's part of what I think I wanted to help people understand in the book is that it's in terms of cancel culture, it's not that people have they still care about free speech in the way that we have traditionally. Now it's, well, I don't really care about giving you the freedom to say what you want to say because what you want to say is harmful. You have harmful ideas. And that is such a different place than where we've been in the past. And I used to kind of naively think, hey, I just don't think that these people who are trying to cancel others understand the slippery slope here. I mean, we're going to lose free speech. And as I was doing more research to learn about this and kind of the background roots of this and critical theory and other things that we can, you know, get into, I realized, wait a second, they actually don't care about free speech. And that was sort of a mind-blowing moment to me because ideas themselves are harmful today. You are an oppressor if you have ideas that go against some of these prevalent moral consensuses of culture, and therefore you should not be allowed to speak because you are evil. You're in a different category.
Well, it may be a refinement needs to be added here. They believe in free speech for themselves, but not for those who disagree. So the free speech thing is a one-way street, just like the tolerance thing is a one-way street, just like the judging is the ultimate sin is a one-way street, because they're filled with judgment for Christians and against Christians, et cetera. So these are telltale signs of something really gone wrong in our culture. Yet at the same time, there is a tremendous pull and appeal of these things to Christians. And this has created an entire movement broadly within Christianity called the Progressive Church. So let's spend a little time talking about that, because this is a huge concern to me and to many like us who are watching the culture and watching what's happening to the church. What is the Progressive Church, and where did it come from, and what do they believe, and why are they a threat?
Yeah, well, there's a lot that we can cover with this, but it's hard to define progressive Christianity in a lot of ways, because if you meet two different progressive Christians, you're probably going to meet two people with very different beliefs. But there's a really big underlying reason for that, and that's because progressive Christians, what unites them in their beliefs is that they tend to reject the ultimate authority of the Bible. So they definitely, in most cases, appreciate the Bible in some sense, in a loose sense. They'll say, you know, yeah, I think the Bible was inspired, meaning that maybe people were inspired to write about God based on their experiences over time, but they don't see the Bible as God's authoritative word of truth that is relevant and applicable for all time. Mm-hmm. It's sort of all evolving so that we now as humans have a better understanding of things. So it kind of follows from that if you don't accept the same source of truth as a biblical Christian would, you're going to end up with all kinds of beliefs because you have no objective basis for your beliefs anymore. Mm-hmm. You're just in a place of picking and choosing what you believe to be the truth about reality. You probably, if you're still identifying with the label of Christian in some sense, have an additional appreciation for Jesus, you know, a love for Jesus. You think that he's a good moral teacher, maybe more than some people who are purely irreligious. But at the same time, you're still putting yourself in this position of picking and choosing. And ultimately, that goes back to the authority of the self. So I make the case in the book in one of my chapters that it's a secular pressure within the church, because it's a pressure to come back to the authority of the self, even in what you believe to be true from the Bible. So progressive Christianity is a major influence in Christian circles today for a lot of people, because when we hear about that 65% of people saying they're a Christian, and only 6% or less, as you pointed out, having a biblical worldview, there are a lot of progressive Christians who are making up that gap, who identify with some beliefs from the Bible that they have selected. And when other Christians look at that and they say, my friends are Christians, but they believe all these other things, then they start to assume that that's legitimate in some way, rather than going back to what the Bible teaches.
Or it's a matter of opinion or a matter of interpretation. Right. I think you hit on something important in describing the progressive church with a mutual friend of ours have written extensively on, Elisa Childers, and that is what seems to me to unify them is not what their doctrine, their positive doctrine is, but what their negative doctrine is, so to speak. And you started out with the foundational one. What they reject is the authority of Scripture. Now, the minute you reject authority of Scripture, as you pointed out, now you don't have any authoritative guidelines regarding other things like sexuality and gender and abortion and a whole range of popular issues. Now, it seems to me, and maybe I'm missing something, but it seems to be in the progressive circles that they are unified in this series of things they reject, which turn out to be the virtually every single thing that secular culture rejects as well. The divinity of Christ, Jesus the only way, hell, all of these things. So when it comes to these vital elements of Christianity, which they reject, they look just like the non-Christian culture, yet they still call themselves Christian.
Right. That's exactly right. I think that when you reject the authority of God and you reject the authority of the Bible and you're back to yourself, you're going to start looking more and more like culture, like all the other people who have the authority of the self, because now we're all coming back to the popular consensus. It's a great irony that we have a lot of authority of the selves running around, but yet they all converge on a popular consensus about what morality should look like, even though there's no objective basis within their secular worldview for having that. So it is really a fascinating direction that you see happen.
Yeah, and there's a rabbit trail here, which I won't really go down. I'll just mention, and that is, it says in Ephesians 6 that the devil has schemes, that is, strategies that we are to be aware of and resist. And when I see everybody going in the same direction, calling for all of their own personal autonomy, but all of their autonomy results in conforming to a completely different worldview that is at every point contrary to the good world that God made for human flourishing. That is a signal to me that maybe there's a scheme of spiritual darkness. I don't want to say a satanic scheme because it sounds too much like the Night of the Living Dead or some. It sounds too extreme. But really, there is a spiritual realm, powers of darkness, and they have plans and strategies. And that's a lot of what I see going on here. So we've got a secular environment that is very, very appealing even to Christians because we're fallen. And there's punishment in place for Christians not going along with that. And we talked about that cancel culture. And so this causes Christians to begin to question the legitimacy of the convictions that they were raised with, okay? And this stage of questioning is called deconstruction. You do a lot in your workbook on this, and I'm so thankful for it because it is a huge issue that the church is facing now, so huge that our next year's reality is going to be focusing on that completely. Introduce us to this concept a little bit. What is deconstruction as opposed to deconversion and the relationship of the two?
So when someone says that they're deconverting, generally what they mean is they're just abandoning any notion of faith. And, you know, they're probably becoming an atheist, agnostic, or maybe nothing in particular, which is what a category that researchers give that where people aren't associating with any of those particular labels. So that's more of the deconversion terminology. People use this term deconstruction in so many different ways today. Mm-hmm. And it can have so many different meanings. Sometimes when someone says, I'm deconstructing, and I'm going to say it's a little naively used this way because it's not really what most people mean by it. But I think sometimes they naively are just saying, well, I'm stepping back, I'm evaluating my beliefs and just making sure that I understand everything correctly as it aligns with the Bible. That's not really what deconstruction means, even though some people use it to mean that. Mm-hmm. So we're always supposed to be looking at our beliefs and making sure that they line up with the Bible. That's not deconstruction. That's just being a biblical Christian. So we want to get away from using terms that the culture is using in a very different sense. But what deconstruction means for a lot of people, or most people when they say that, is that they're walking away from the historic Christian faith and the authority of the Bible specifically. It almost always means that someone has become a progressive Christian. They're associating with that particular label now, and deconstruction means they're just walking away from the things that they assumed to be true before about the authority of the Bible, and now they're looking at their faith from these different progressive eyes. So it's almost always a signal that someone's become a progressive Christian. It's kind of a fancy term for just that exactly.
Yeah. I know that Tim Barnett has this clever little aphorism where he talks about this process because, as you've just identified, there is a completely legitimate place for taking a closer look at your convictions and seeing if they're true. And in fact, if you're a younger person being raised in the church, there of necessity is a time when you cease believing something because you were raised that way and your parents believed in it, and you start believing in it because these are convictions you're willing to own. That transition can be hard. And I have teenage girls, so I know what that's like. And it even caught me by surprise when it began to happen in my family, Natasha. And I know better, and it still really caught me by surprise. But so that's a good thing, that there's an assessment. The problem is if they're in a community of Christians where there are no good answers to the legitimate questions that they're raising. And this is what you've done with a lot of your prior work, keeping your kids on God's side, talking to your kids about God and about Jesus, etc. So you provide a lot of good material there. But in this book, Faithfully Different, you offer, you talk about three steps of deconversion that... Well, you talk about three steps of deconversion. You probably referred to it a little bit. Can you isolate those more specifically for us?
Yeah. So what I'm trying to bring to light is that when people make headlines because they're deconstructing or deconverting, it's often because they are framing this narrative in a very specific way. That's not just, hey, I just want to let you guys know something, but rather sort of reverse evangelism. They want to tell people that there's good reason for you to reconsider everything too. And so it's kind of predictable when you look at it. And so that's why I've isolated it into these three steps. The first one is they'll announce the catalyst. So it's the catalyst of, you know, I've been a Christian my whole life or for many years, and I believe this just like you, but then I started to realize how unreasonable it was or how much the church has hurt people. Fill in the blank. There is some catalyst that they identify. And then the second thing that they talk about is what I call the avalanche of questions. And they almost always will list a series of big questions that, if you've ever studied apologetics, should come as no surprise to you whatsoever, but that they identify as if they're sort of one of the first people to think about these things, to point them out and throw them out at you as if, hey, did you ever think about this? That if there's a good God, how could there be evil? Or, you know, why does God look different in the Old and New Testaments? Or have you ever noticed how many contradictions are in the Bible? So you start to hear all of these, this series of questions. And the implication is, I looked into these questions and there were no good answers. No one could answer my questions that I had. And so I've decided to walk away or deconstruct, whatever the case may be. And of course, if you're not well grounded in your Bible and apologetics, understanding how to defend your faith and these kinds of questions, then you're going to look at that and think, wow, they've looked into this and there weren't good answers. So what does that mean for me? I haven't looked into it. And what other questions are there that I don't know about? So you have this avalanche of questions. And then the third part of it is what I call the happy ending. There's always the cap on the story that goes back to happiness is the ultimate goal. They always tell you how happy they are. That's the big conclusion to the story. Don't feel bad for me. Don't worry about me. I appreciate you, Christian friends, but I'm in the best place I've ever been. I'm happy now. And the implication is, hey, there's nothing wrong with what I've done. I've just deconstructed my faith, and now I'm happy.
It really is a little... And I got rid of all that old bag.
Yeah, I'm free.
I got rid of all that awful baggage, right?
I'm free to be me, which comes back to our old friend, the authority of the self. So when you hear people talking about that, and they're free from this so-called oppressive system, and now they're back to their own authority, once again, we see the appeal in these deconversion narratives, because it's encouraging you to think, well, I can be on my own authority too.
You know, Natasha, as I reflect on and sometimes occasionally speak on my own conversion, my testimony about what happened to me in the mid-60s when I left the church that I was raised in, I guess you could say deconstructed and deconverted after a fashion, and then eventually became a follower of Jesus in the early 70s, I mentioned this exact thing, this sense of freedom that I felt. That I have no God over me, No one tells me what to do. I can make all my own choices. And of course, I'm now emancipating from my parents at this time. This is for me in the mid 60s, where there's a whole lot of things changing. And when you're 18, you know, and 17, 18 years old, you know, a young man, you don't want to think about, you know, religion and purity and all of that kind of stuff that messes up your game plan. And so there is this euphoria that one feels after they cast off the kind of shackles of religion. And that's the appeal that's made here. So we talked about the legitimacy of doubting, of raising questions. What would you say, and how do you characterize this in your book, Faithfully Different, the right way for young Christians to deal with doubts and for parents to deal with their young Christian kids who are dealing with doubts?
Yeah, so I spend the rest of that chapter actually going through 10 different things to think about if you want to be an honest seeker of truth when you're dealing with doubts. And over a couple of them, I think the number one thing that I have on there is to be honest with yourself about the nature of truth. Truth is not what we want to be true. It's not what costs us the least. It's not what our friends think is true. We have to start with just acknowledging that truth is going to be objective. It's going to be something that's outside of those things. And I think that a lot of times when you see people walk away, it almost looks like there's this layer of Christianity is not what I wanted to be true. I wanted these other things to be true over here. So when you're going to seek truth, you have to start with just acknowledging, okay, I want to follow the evidence wherever it leads. I want to look for what's true.
This is not about what people like, and this is, to me, this is one of the hardest things to get across to people. I didn't like that about Christianity. I like Buddhism. I like those ideas. Well, I liked Eastern religion back then because it was low on personal responsibility and high on personal freedom. What's not to like? You're saying that's not the right question. The right question is, what is actually so? What is the nature of reality? What kind of world do we actually, in fact, live in, regardless of whether we like the answer or not? That's the foundation.
That's got to be the first thing before you actually go on a genuine pursuit of truth, is to ask that question. And I think another thing, and like I said, there are 10 different things there, so I'm just kind of thinking off the top of my head about some of the more important ones from that.
But I forget what I write too, so no problem.
I know, I'm thinking back to that chapter. But one of the things that you see a lot today is the church is hurtful, or a Christian hurt me, and therefore I started deconstructing my faith. In fact, I just saw someone say this today, that they were really rethinking everything because they knew somebody, a Christian, who had really hurt them, and their church had been hurtful to them in some way. However they define hurt, I don't know. That's personal to them. But we have to be really careful to remember that even if a church did hurt you, and there are a lot of churches who have legitimately hurt people, or even if a Christian has legitimately hurt you, that has no bearing on whether or not Christianity is true. And we have to separate those things. We're going to have personal hurts in life for very different reasons, but that doesn't mean that Christianity is not true. We have to seek truth outside of whether or not we've been hurt in some way. So I think that's another big one that people tend to miss.
The irony on this one is it isn't as if going into the secular world, you are going to be pain-free in relationships. Yeah, there's the safe place to go. Nobody's going to bother you. Nobody's going to say mean things about you. Nobody's going to hurt you. Nobody's going to cheat on you or cheat you. Everybody's going to be just wonderful. Of course, that's not the case, because in both sides, Christians, non-Christians, you have fallen people who do things consistent with being fallen, you know. But for some reason, and I don't entirely understand it, but there are a lot of those who have deconverted precisely for this reason. They've had a bad experience in the church, and so they've gone elsewhere, you know. It doesn't make any sense to me. And on the one hand, it makes sense that they would be predisposed to question Christianity because of bad experiences with Christians. That makes sense. But then to say, okay, Christianity must be false, and so I'm going to embrace a secular world where what? You know, it's like red in tooth and claw. It's a nasty world out there. You know, why is that any really better by this criteria? I don't know. But you said there are more.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. People are only seeing it from one side. And I think that's one of the other points that are in there, that that you also have to think about not just what you're walking away from, but what are you walking to? So many people don't think about that. They just know, I'm going to reject this, but they don't consider the actual worldview that they're going to hold next. They don't realize that there are unanswered questions in every worldview, that they're going to have doubts in any worldview because there are unanswered questions. They're only thinking about what they're walking away from. And I think that that is something that's hugely important, I think, for parents especially, to communicate to their kids, because you see so many kids who walk toward this sort of nothing in particular. Well, mm-hmm. You don't have a actual nothing in particular worldview.
Right.
Every person
right.
has a worldview. And the same researchers that we were talking about earlier from Arizona Christian University, they've also shown that 88% of Americans have an inconsistent, incoherent worldview. It's just pure syncretism. They're picking and choosing and pulling. And this isn't just Christians. This is mm-hmm. everyone. When you look at the philosophical right. underpinnings of people's worldviews and you actually look at the beliefs that they claim to have, they don't line up. They're not actually logically consistent with one another. So this comes back to, if you're going to walk away from something, make sure that you've actually thought about this new worldview that you're claiming to have. Does it logically make sense? Does it actually mm-hmm. correspond with reality? Is there evidence for the truth of it?
Yeah, the question I ask at this point is simply, what's the alternative? What's the alternative? Okay, so I understand, I'm completely sympathetic to the idea that people who get hurt in the church by people doing bad things to them become atheists. Okay, but now there's no God. Yeah. So what moral sense do you make of the behaviors of the people who hurt you before if you are convinced that there's no God? Because what they were doing is just stuff. There's no basis for objective morality. And this is another discussion that sometimes Christians get confused on. But if there is no lawmaker, there are no objective laws. There are just people's opinions about things. They're stuck in a relativistic world. Okay, so if you get rid of God, now you've just gotten rid of the kind of morality that you were expressing concern about regarding the Christians who hurt you. So now what? And I think there's a lot of ramifications to that kind of a move, but the moral one is just one of them. But this is what you're getting at. And I think this is a question that, as you pointed out, parents have to ask their own children. Okay, what's next? What's the alternative? There is no such thing as a nothing. You are going to something else. You reject one thing, you have to go to something else. You reject God, that's atheism. Now, what does atheism give you in your life that's going to help resolve other issues and whatever? So I'm trying to think. I don't want to get into critical theory. We don't have enough time for that. But I do want to mention that I think you did a great job in dealing with it, because this is a huge issue. It's towards the end of your book, and it requires more time in an interview than what the 10 minutes that we have left. So let me go back to some of the things that you said that are RXs, so to speak, repair things. You mentioned one, for example, about being committed to truth. We're not even assuming what that truth happens to be, but let's just say we are committed to finding out what's true. And you also talk here about regaining a supernatural worldview. How is a young Christian, a young person who's a Christian who is in the process of deconstructing, starting to abandon their views because they've heard some, how do you suggest they begin to, following truth, reestablish or regain a supernatural worldview?
Well, I think that even a lot of Christians who hold to a biblical worldview can live as functional atheists sometimes. We yeah. claim to believe in God. We claim to have Jesus as our Savior, but we just go about living our day-to-day lives as if He's not really there. We are prayerless. We don't read our Bibles. We kind of just wait until we die eventually, and then we're going to be zapped up to heaven in some way. And that was kind of the view I had coming out of being a kid and leaving home after hundreds of hours in church, that it wasn't really ingrained into me how to consistently live as though God is right there with me and remembering what that entails for my life. And so I think that if somebody is actually considering, you know, whether or not Christianity is true, the first step toward that and regaining a supernatural worldview is looking at the evidence for God's existence. So stepping back and saying, well, what evidence is there that there actually is something beyond this natural world? And so I go in that chapter into, you know, some of the basic arguments for God's existence, the cosmological argument, the moral argument, design argument, things that you talk about often on the show. And I think that when you look at these arguments for God's existence, it doesn't mean there are no more questions. Mm-hmm. It just means that these are the existence of a creator God, a life-designing God, a universe-designing God, a moral law-giving God is the best explanation for reality. And right. I think that that's what people have to remember when you start pursuing these questions and saying, well, hey, if I step back, how do I know that God actually exists? You're not looking for something that's going to tell you that with 100% certainty, there are no further questions that you have. There's no doubt whatsoever. You're not looking for that. That is a too high of a barrier where you're looking for that kind of proof. We're looking at, here are the pieces of evidence. What's the best explanation? Yeah, did it all like come about just by chance? Is that the best explanation by chance? Mm-hmm. Or is it the existence of a being who meets these criteria?
And if you accept that it's all by chance, that has ramifications for other things, like deep, transcendent personal meaning and value. I have made a comment that an atheist scoffed at recently, and I'm talking about this issue of human value, and I said, we all know that humans have transcendent value, which is why we can gas termites but not Jews. And he just thought that was a terrible thing to say. But tell me what the alternative is. You think that it's okay to gas Jews versus termites? I mean, this is the implication of worldviews. And this is one of the things you cover in the book, Reclaiming What Rightfully Belongs to a Biblical Worldview. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I point out in that chapter that there are a lot of things that we intuitively cherish as humans, like human equality and human rights and justice and free will, things that we take for granted all the time, and that secular culture a lot of times is trumpeting as well. But they have no actual objective basis for their things within their own worldview. So that's the great irony in this all, is that they look at Christians and they criticize Christians for their worldview, but then they take those values, they take those things that can only be derived from within our worldview, they take them and then they use them against us. And so that chapter is really just to encourage Christians to think a little bit more deeply about these things. Think about, where does objective morality come from? Where could it possibly come from? What about human rights? Well, who is there to give you rights? Rights are something that you're entitled to. Who is there to entitle you to those rights? Right. Equality. Well, where do you get that if you don't have someone to imbue all human beings with value, with equal value? Where do you get that from? And so it's interesting because you just see all the time the culture enjoying the benefits of believing in these rights and all of these different concepts, and yet they don't have the objective basis in their own worldview for them.
Right.
So the more we can understand that as Christians, the more that we can appreciate the coherence, the internal coherence of our own worldview and how that points to truth.
Yeah, I like the way you expressed it earlier. I say the same thing. It's the best. Christianity is the best explanation for the way things are. First, we get a clear fix on the way things are, and that is, humans seem to be the kind of creatures that have rights, for example, that there is a problem of evil in the world. Things aren't the way they're supposed to be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then say, okay, here are our options. Classically, theism or atheism, you know, and so which point of view is going to make the best sense of those options? Do you have, we're kind of winding down here, but I'm just wondering, do you see America at all turning back to more traditional values?
I don't personally.
Or do you think that we're on a course that's not reversible in any meaningful sense?
Well, God can reverse anything at any time. So obviously we have to always say that, you know, that's going to be in God's hands. But personally, I don't see that direction happening. And the reason for that is that when you look at the data behind all this worldview research, over the last 25 years, the percent of people with a biblical worldview has declined by half. So this is a trend that's been going on for quite a while. but mm-hmm. we haven't noticed it as much. It hasn't been as obvious until recent times because we had this long hangover of values that our culture still shared that were consistent with a biblical worldview. So we still had a culture that was still valuing the family in the same way, that was still valuing marriage and valuing things that Christians value. Even though they had mm-hmm. discarded the doctrinal tenets of Christianity right. quite a long time ago, we the didn't notice it,
right.
the foundations for that. They still had the values. We had this long hangover. But really, in recent years, has been the acceleration of getting rid of the values themselves that were consistent with the Christian worldview. And now Christians notice. Now it's like, mm-hmm. oh, wow, everyone's against us. And now there's this hostile culture where, well, no one... For a long time, there have been a lot of people who haven't agreed with the doctrinal tenets of Christianity. It's just that it right. wasn't as apparent to us because the culture still hung on to some of these values. So with yeah. that said, I don't see it turning around because it's already been in decline for decades. It's just that now some of the cultural forces are making us notice it a lot more. And I think that we're beyond the point where everyone's going to suddenly turn around, unless there's a giant revival. You never know what God's going to do.
Yeah, you never know. But I think the ideological decline has been happening for a long time. And what we are seeing recently is the more practical application of the ideological decline. And that is picking up momentum at an unbelievable pace. As an observer, just the last 10 years, the last 5 years, the last 2 years, the kinds of things that are going on, and it's been very frightening. If I were to ask you here in the last 60 seconds, what is the key takeaway you hope that your readers will get out of your wonderful new book, Faithfully Different, what would you say?
I'd have to say that the biblical worldview is vastly different than the secular worldview, and that once we understand those differences, we're going to be in a better position to believe, think, and live differently as Christians. And with that, we can have a better relationship with the Lord ourselves and be better positioned to be salt and light in today's culture. And so I hope that my book is going to equip people to do that.
Well, I'm going to add a little to that because I got 30 more seconds. That was really quick. And good, and right to the point. But you also make this case is that there are reasons, good solid reasons, to trust that the biblical worldview is an accurate view of reality. And therefore, when we follow the biblical guidelines, it doesn't mean we're always going to be happy and et cetera. There are judgments that are involved there. It doesn't mean we're in charge. It means God's in charge. So they're contrary to the secular trends, yet at the same time, we are going to be living in the world the way it actually is, and ultimately that's going to bear long-term fruit for us. So what a treat to be talking to you about this. I don't know if you've got a sixth book, or is this the fifth? I'm trying to look. I lose count now. This is the fourth one. But this is a magnificent work. You cover so much ground. I gave it my highest marks. This is one of those books where I would tell people, if you read one book this year to help you understand the culture for your family and for your children, it is Natasha Crane's wonderful Faithfully Different, Regaining Biblical Clarity in a Secular Culture. Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you so much.
All right, friends, that's it for this show. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.